Welcome to the January 5th edition of In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm your host, Ken Osborne. We've gathered the experts to talk tech today, answer your questions, and probably raise a few more. It's unlikely to know. We have from Exigent, Chief Information Security Officer Amos Aesop is here. Hello, Amos. It's good to see you.
There
I am. Now I can finally hear you.
Yeah.
And from the Bureau in Pierre, Jeff Litterick joins us on the line. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
Frosty day in Pierre, I take it?
It's been worse this week, so I'll take what we have today. So.
Absolutely. So the equipment's thawing out and everything's cool. Have you had any weather-related issues? Is it how's the weather on equipment?
It's outside of batteries and stuff. Cold weather is actually pretty good for electronics. The electronics hate heat, any type of heat, and all heat destroys over time electronics. So they work pretty good. Batteries, though, if you have a weak battery, it will show up pretty quickly under cold weather. But so far, everything like that's been holding up pretty good. So.
You know, I guess I noticed that in my not only my car but in my laptop that brought my one laptop in out of the cold and it said there was, you know, it gave me the big battery symbol with the red, you know, indicator on it, and after it warmed up I had 90-some% battery, so it must, you know, it must really hurt batteries the cold that is.
Yeah, it doesn't really remove the charge, but what it does, it actually. Batteries were discharged slower under a cold battery, but what it does is it limits how much peak power it can produce and how fast it can draw the power out of the battery. So you feel it sluggish, but it really hasn't lost it. It's still there. It just can't supply it as fast as the computer really wants it at that time. So once it warms up, it'll be okay again.
Cool. Well, once now that we're talking about batteries, we might as well talk about the big HP recall. It was voluntary, I'm assuming.
Any time you have lithium-ion fire risks, I would highly suggest that you do the recall, be it voluntary or not. This is one of the reasons why lithium-ion is banned from cargo hold of passenger planes now and stuff, electronics. You have to always carry on anything with a battery. In some cases, you have to remove the battery and carry it separately because of fire risks. Luckily, there are some new technologies, lithium air and some other technologies that remove that fire risk completely. I hope to see come out that are as good or even better than lithium ion. But lithium ion is the mainstay of most batteries today. Even AA's and stuff, you can get lithium versions now. So be aware that any kind of rechargeable lithium always carries some kind of fire risk, and any time there's a recall, it's serious enough to make sure you recall. It may only affect, you know, 10, 12 people, but you don't want to be the person that suddenly your laptop catches on fire in the middle of a conference or at home and burns down your home because the fire is going to spread. So because it's a very hot fire. So
definitely safety first. I've put a link to HP's explanation of this on our Facebook page, facebook.com/techradio. Lists the model numbers of the laptops that are of issue, and there's even a tool you can run, and if your battery is affected by this recall, it will, I don't know what the magic is, but it goes in and puts it in some sort of emergency mode or low power mode or something to help keep it from exploding on you. But so anyway, all the details.
Once it discharges, it will refuse to recharge that battery. So at that point, you do need to replace it because you're not going to be able to recharge it at all. So be careful with that. But, yes, but because it's a recall, it's not like you're paying any costs. Just, you know, replace the batteries.
Sure. And will my laptop, if I've sent my battery in, will I at least be able to plug that into the wall and use it on the dock? Without the battery, that battery doesn't need to make a connection or anything in the computer, right?
Different laptops are different. Some laptops you can remove the battery entirely and it will still run on just by plugging it in without any battery. Some require the battery to be in there even though it's not using the battery. Power still has to flow through the battery cells, or some kind of detection of the battery has to be there in order for it to work. So there are different models that will do different things. You can always test, remove the battery, and see if you can power up. If you can't, you need to have, even a dead battery will work. You just need to have that battery physically in there.
Jeff, I'm looking at the bottom of my HP laptop. I don't see a removable battery here.
Well, depending on the model, many of the HP laptop batteries right now are replaceable and removable, but you have to remove the bottom cover of the laptop. And that includes, I've actually had to do this. My last laptop came with a DOA battery, in fact, and I had to replace it. And it was a pain because there's a lot of screws. And the screws on many models are different lengths, so you have to keep track of what screw goes in what screw hole. And you have to pry up a whole bunch of the rubber coverings off, and they won't basically stay back on anyway once you do that the first time. But once you do that, you can remove the screws, and the whole bottom comes right off. It's just plastic, and the battery is very easily replaceable.
This does not sound like a job for Kent, but a tech or a service person or a knowledgeable friend can take care of that for you?
Yep. The main thing is just watching what screws are in what holes, because there are different lengths. And you need to put the same screw back in the same hole you took out. And this, like on my model, there were 16 screws I had to remove. But once done, it just lifted right off. There were no wires in the way or anything. It was basically pull the battery up, put the battery back in a few seconds, and then put the cover back on. But getting the cover off was a major deal, because there was a lot of prying of rubber feet and stuff, finding out, oh, I missed that screw and stuff like that. So I would highly suggest you have someone knowledgeable with electronics to do that. The main point is watch all your screws.
And sure. In some cases, that doing that without authorization will actually void your warranty. So you want to make sure that your device is considered user serviceable before you start unscrewing stuff.
Good point. And so, like I mentioned, if your laptop has the letters H and P on it, go out to their site, or there's an easy link on our Facebook page. And while you're there, give us a like or give us a comment. We'd like you to do that. Give us some feedback. Tell us about your holiday. Did you get any tech this year? How'd that go? Are you still trying to figure it out, or you're an old hat at it by now with some Christmas vacation time behind you? We'd love to hear some tech stories from the holidays from you as well. Give us a call. 800-524-3604 is our studio number if you'd like to go on the air, or if you'd simply like to send us a text, that's 956-SDPB, 956-7372. Of course, most people use the email address in the moment at stpb.org. We'd love to get the emails as well. Descriptive as you can with your problem and when it started and what the particular rub is with the device, and we'll try to extol some knowledge today and let you know what we know here. Amos and Joel, or actually Joel's ill today. We're wishing him the best, and Amos and Jeff will help answer your questions today. So again, don't be shy. 800-524-3604. So, guys, I was greeted in 2018 with a couple of words that I didn't want to hear, and with Intel processors, Spectre and Meltdown, not encouraging words that I want to hear about my chips in my computers. And I'm unclear on this, so you're going to have to kind of clue me in here. I hear it's all Intel CPUs since like 1995.
Yeah, okay. And there's other manufacturers too. There's some discrepancy amongst AMD. There's been some official publication by AMD saying they are. There's been other people who have said they aren't. Or I guess I got that backwards. That the AMDs are not vulnerable. There's other brands too that you really have to pay attention to.
One thing to remember is there's two different things kind of working on the same flaw. And it's a design flaw in all CPUs. Every CPU has this design flaw. It's made since about the Pentium Pro, so late 1990s. The Meltdown is Intel only. Spectre is every single CPU and every single device.
That's why I see the iPhones and the other things then. Okay, so that clears that up for me.
Meltdown is the one we're patching. Microsoft already has released an out-of-sequence patch, so sort of people are not getting it because some antivirus programs have blue screens of death problems with the patch. So Microsoft is only rolling it out if it knows your system is safe to install it. But they started rolling that out yesterday afternoon. in kind of a hurry because everything, everyone was planned to announce all this stuff on January 9th. And it got leaked early, so everyone's kind of scrambling. But Meltdown is Intel only. It's the major one you're patching. Inspector has no patches. There is no way to defend against it without recompiling and actually changing all the compilers out there and then recompiling every program. But Spectre is much harder to pull off. It's not as easy as Meltdown. So there's two things. Just be aware Spectre's going to be around for a while Meltdown is being patched next week.
Okay. That's good news. And, they said 90% of computers released in the last 5 years will be patched by the end of next week. So that's good.
One thing to remember with these patches is first of all, we talk about vulnerabilities, security, and exploits. The first thing to be aware of with these, both of these are what's called data disclosure exploits, in that they can't use this to take over your computer right away, but they can use this to read all the data in memory on your computer. And even the browsers are patching. Firefox released a patch last week to help with this, because even after the patches next week for the OSs, the kernels, what will happen is you can use the same Spectre exploit or Meltdown exploit to actually read memory within your browser. So a website, and Firefox proved this, they have a big blog entry on it, that you could, from a website, actually read all the other application and data, like the tab that has your email open in your browser window. So it's important to keep all your browsers patched up too. Firefox has a fix out, IE has a fix out in this new patch. As long as you're IE 11 or above, you need to be at least IE 11. And we think Chrome has one, but they haven't officially announced that I have seen it patched. But this it's not really a security thing. It's basically a vulnerability that was found in the way CPUs work. It's a fundamental way CPUs work. So the long-term solution is this, is to redesign how CPUs work, and that's going to take a while. And that requires all new hardware. These new types of attacks will be with us for a long time, until everyone probably replaces hardware that doesn't even exist yet.
But
it may be one or two generations of CPU hardware before these attacks are fully dealt with in hardware.
I want to ask about something you just said. You said it's not a software but a kind of a hardware deal. The problem is, but to be exploited on my computer, I need to have a malicious piece of software installed on there, sort of either with or without me knowing it, correct?
No. This is why Firefox proof. All you need to do is run a browser to a bad website. JavaScript will handle the rest, because they've already have proven just hitting the website and doing the JavaScript the website downloads. So, yes, you have to run code on your machine, but remember, you run a lot of code that doesn't get installed in your machine. Word macros, JavaScript from websites, extensions in your browser, stuff like that. So after your OS, the next biggest thing to make sure is keep all your browsers patched up. There's already patches coming out and stuff. But this one, and remember, all they can do is steal your data. They can't take over your machine with this. But they could steal enough data to take over your machine with a different exploit, with a different method, right? But all we're talking about right now is basically stealing all your data, including your usernames, passwords, out of memory.
And those are because it's listening in on the software that's running on your machine, right?
Right. It can actually, normally, without getting too technical, your CPU enforces certain security on your machine. So when one application tries to access another application's memory or the kernel memory, it's denied. There's a security in place at the hardware layer saying you can't do that. That way, Word cannot attack Firefox, right, directly. You have to go through the kernel and the security permissions. What this flaw does is bypass all those security permissions so that Firefox, yes, can read your username and password in your OS when it normally could not be able to. And the hardware is what enforces that at a very low layer, and that's what's broken. So, like I said, it's a redesign of how CPUs work to put that security back fully in place. And this has been with chips since the Pentium Pro. So this is a long-term kind of thing that no one thought could be exploited, but suddenly about five different researchers all within about a month last year, found out how to do this. And the patches have been, these are not super emergency patches. The vendors have all known about this since November, last November when it was discovered, and they have been working on this stuff for a while, trying to keep it secret until January 9th. Unfortunately, it got leaked a week ahead, so everyone is now scrambling to get their patches out. And this affects every OS. Every Linux box needs to be patched. Androids need to be patched. You know, anything with an infected CPU needs to be patched. And it is the problem with this is because this is the way the CPU works, the patch puts some software fixes in, and it's going to slow the computers down slightly. Most users are going to see a 2 to 5% slowness after the patch is applied. There's no real way to get around that. Servers, the big server clouds are going to see a bigger impact. Database, if you're running databases, you can see up to 30% lower performance after the patch. And it's because the software is having to do things a different way and to hide this vulnerability, and there's not much way around it because it's a hardware-based thing. So that's what a lot of us, especially with server farms and data sets, have been really working on benchmarks and stuff like that for our different applications, because there will be a performance hit after the patch. There's no way around that, and everyone will see it, even desktop users. But most desktop users probably see maybe 2%, maybe 5% at the most loss of performance. But the server farms are going to, in some cases, going to see a humongous performance hit. So everyone's kind of testing and trying to do benchmarking with these patches right now.
Amos, you've been doing a lot of testing?
Oh my goodness, we've been dealing with this since early yesterday morning, kind of continuously with between our own equipment and customers who are concerned.
Right.
The one thing I wanted to mention was I saw this on the national news last night on one of the 5:30 news, and of course it's in their interest to make this more interesting, but they made it sound like this guy was falling and you basically should shut your computer off and that every
it's
machine.
It's named Spectre and Meltdown, okay?
Yeah, it is. It is. They're cool names that come from, various places. Maybe I might be the person who found it first. It might be, various, maybe sometimes it's in the code. It just depends on what the particular vulnerability is. But this isn't the sky is falling issue. Okay. It's definitely an issue to be aware of. Have we ever mentioned people should update their computers on a regular basis?
I think we have.
Because
and be wary of third-party things and keep updated.
Because that's one of those. This is one of those times where there's nothing you can do but wait for the manufacturer to produce an update. And Jeff's right, there is forecasted to be a performance hit. It is very dependent upon what we call a workload or the type of number crunching your computer is doing. And so Jeff's right, from the average user probably won't notice it. If you're running a high-end SQL database, you're probably going to notice it. But again, just make sure your computer is updating don't lose sleep over this one.
And when you see the security update come on for your phone or for whatever, go ahead and do it.
Right.
I hear Google's going to have an Android patch today.
Yeah.
And so I'll be waiting for that.
I did just read that Apple has announced that all of their platforms are vulnerable. So this would be the Macs, this would be the iPhones, the iPads. Again, just do your standard updates to all of those devices and you should be smooth sailing for you.
Diligence is the word for the day.
It is.
Thank you. And we're going to put a wrap on Spectre. And I wish I had a sound effect I could do when I say Spectre and Meltdown. but I don't. We're going to put a wrap on that. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some online photo storage from a question from a listener. And dive into CES 2018 after this quick break. We are back in the moment on SDPB Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Our Facebook page, facebook.com/techradio. Our phone number, 800-524-3604. Twitter users, of course, KentSDPB, @KentSDPB, and the email address again, in the moment at sdpb.org. We did get a text at 956-SDPB. The text says, will you talk about digital online photo storage? My iPhone is full of photos. I am hesitant to use iCloud because I'm afraid it will start to nickel and dime me. I have Amazon Prime, and there seems to be free photo storage with that. I have also looked at online photo printing options like Shutterfly and Snapfish. What's a girl to do? Amos, what do you do with your iPhone? You don't have an iPhone.
I don't have an iPhone. Okay. I know. But I do have a phone, and it does take pictures. And,
yes.
And I do take a lot of them, and I do back them up to the cloud.
Okay.
And so
where
I use Google's photos, which if set to the right settings, which is not uploading the pictures in the highest quality, but in still pretty darn good quality. You have unlimited storage with your account. There's also unlimited storage with an Amazon Prime account, which I was trying to see how that works with the iPhone. I'm sure there's a method that Amazon and iPhones are too big of a deal to not work together. But yeah, using the Amazon Prime storage, you do have unlimited storage there as well.
I found that out a few years ago when I started moving some of my older hard drives, family photos and things up there, just for the simple fact that it is free and you're on Amazon's cloud service. So what's more reliable than that? I mean, there are more reliable things, but when it goes down big, but it's usually up.
Right. Yeah. Turns out there is an app. There's an iOS app called Prime Photos. Use that. And, you know, the nice thing about that is that if you do want to share it, say you take a bunch of pictures at a family reunion or a wedding or some sort of event, you can take and then group those photos together and share them without sharing all of your photos, right? So you could send out a link that says, hey, here's all my pictures that I took at, the wedding from this weekend or whatever. And people can then view them and download them, save them, whatever they want to do with them. So it's using that cloud feature is pretty handy. Plus, if your phone ever gets dropped in the lake or gets smashed by a bus or whatever, those photos then, again, if your settings are correct, are available continuously because they're backed up to the cloud.
Okay. Go ahead, Jeff.
For me, I actually use an Android. I actually back them up not to Google Photos, which is a valid service, but to actually Google Drive. Which has free space and stuff too, but not unlimited. And then I can share the same things through there. But the nice thing with Google Drive is they're kept in their original format and resolution. So if you are a high-end photographer and you're taking raw photographs or special high resolutions you want to keep, Google Photo is good for, you know, the basic stuff. But if you want a really high resolution, you want to keep it, just put it up to Google Drive. If you're using Google Photo, you already have 5 gig free on Google Drive no matter what. To use that works just as well, and does it reduce the image resolution? So,
I don't have any experience with either Shutterfly or Snapfish, although I'm familiar with them. I'm a Flickr user, and that is fairly seamless to be able to back up and share as well.
I don't have experience using those as a storage medium. I do using them as a way to convert them into a physical picture. Both Snapfish and Shutterfly will do, take a collection of photos and turn it into a book or turn it into a poster or turn it into something that looks that is professionally bound and put together and very nice. I've seen that done several times and it's really good quality, but not for using it as storage.
So they're mimicking the iCloud experience or the Apple experience with that because they carry those features as well.
Yeah.
But as she mentions, I don't know what the costs are. Our resident Mac guru is under the weather today, unfortunately. But we'll continue to check into that. But that's some good options for you. Certainly Amazon or if you're perhaps not a Google user on the iPhone, but maybe you are, some options there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, moving on, I wanted to talk a little bit about CES today. The Consumer Electronics Show is getting set for 2018, and it'll be without Pi this year. Ajit Pai was supposed to show up, and he's under the way. He just had to cancel.
Is he not interested? And not invited any longer?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it was rescinding any invitations. He just his schedule got busy and he couldn't make it. I don't know why.
Sure,
but anything you're looking for? I see the smart home is supposed to get smarter. which I guess is good with me. I mean, there's a reason we're doing all this, and it's to make our lives easier, right? And so let's get there.
It is. And along with that, I think I mentioned this before, the S in IoT stands for security. So when you're buying those things, just be aware that there is no security in most of these devices, right? Kind of on your own to make sure things are updated. A lot of cool stuff comes out at CES. Some of it makes it into prime time. Some of it doesn't. Some of it is just for the wow factor or conversation and getting you talking about a particular brand or a particular technology. So it'll be interesting to see. I actually have not, unfortunately, been able to pay a whole lot of attention to what's predicted and what's coming up, although I'm sure there'll be bigger, better TVs, right? And
thinner PCs and bendable and 8K and all those things that you normally associate with TVs. Some interesting projector stuff supposed to be coming down the pike, which always interests me.
Yeah.
On the other end, on the smart home end of things, Kohler, if you're familiar with your faucets and your toilets and showers and things, they're making an app for that, of course.
Alexa, flush the toilet.
Or close the lid.
Right.
Those types of things. And it sounds fruity and everything and weird, but really, you spend a lot of time in that room every day.
Mm-hmm.
Why not have connected products so you can... I see the mirror has a little, Alexa-powered thing. You can talk to your mirror.
Sure.
And I don't know if it has a camera in it or not and sees back and is able to tell you things like, hey, you missed a spot or, you forgot to comb that colic or whatever. Right. But it makes sense to me that it moves in that room, but the technology, that is. But it's just really, again, the app. You want 5 cups of water for your whatever, you can tell the faucet to dispense 5 cups of water.
Oh, sure.
But you're doing that with the app. How comfortable you are doing it, I can just measure it out myself, but these things sort of make sense.
You can. And Joel can also turn on and off his overhead lights with a flick of a switch, but he's, got the 40... those light bulbs that he just talks to Alexa and has him turn them on.
Right.
It's again, I think we talked about this a while back, that a lot of these technologies are done that seem goofy and not really worth the effort. But really what they're doing is they're priming these technologies to make a better, more useful purpose out of them. And you get all of these people who are doing your beta testing for voice technologies and for communication types between the devices and, for just various operations within your home. And the information they learn from that about way things are working or not working for that matter will be utilized to make bigger things that are more important or more useful.
So I've got two questions coming out of this so far, only two. you mentioned Internet of Things and security. Mm-hmm. Is there somebody working on a security protocol or a security layer or something for these Internet of Things that everybody can agree on and it's going to tighten this stuff up?
The problem is that there are so many manufacturers and some of the stuff is so easy to produce these days. If you go to there's an app that I've been browsing lately called Wish, which brings products over from the Far East, from China and Japan and that sort of stuff for incredibly inexpensive pricing. But they're no-name products that have been built in a factory with, zero tolerance or zero realization for any sort of security. They're just quickly throwing these things together so that they get the product out the door. I actually bought a dash cam for $3 that I had been looking at that normally, it had the same form factor as when I was looking at for $145. And I thought for $3, I guess I could certainly look at it.
Uh-huh.
But the problem is getting all of those manufacturers to adhere to that same standard, to adhere to those security, realms to incorporate that into the original manufacturing process is very, very difficult.
Can't you worry about that, though, after you have one? I mean, is somebody working on one? I guess what I want to know.
Security standards?
Yeah, for Internet of Things.
There's very well, that's such a broad category. There's, mm-hmm. I mean, there's security standards amongst communication. There's security standards amongst how things are stored. There's security standards amongst, you know, just all the various facets. And to my knowledge, there's none that covers everything. But, you know, again, it's getting, once those items are manufactured, if that capability is not inherent in the device, there's nothing you can do when you get it home. For instance, if you're sending wireless video across your home from, say, your front porch to your kitchen so you can see who's ringing the doorbell, and yes. that's not encrypted, if that device didn't come with encryption technology built in,
right.
there's nothing you're going to do when you get it home to turn on that encryption or, okay. or make it work.
And part of the problem is, well, there's the cheap manufacturers and all the copycat and pirated stuff. Manufacturers, for example, if you look up certain manufacturers, they're going to have like an ISO rating and like a 9000 rating. Those ratings ensure a whole bunch of different things, but they nowadays also ensure that products coming out have a basic security framework built into them.
Okay.
Usually using the NIST standards, but it's a little bit different, and different devices, you know, are going to need different little security tweaks and tricks there. But just like Amos said, what you make it in China, what happens is that company that's making it, they just copy it without any of the security features or that up the cost that the company with the ISO rating has to put in and sell it for $3. So, you know, it's really the Internet of Things. And when we mean things, we mean everything. From your, you know, your refrigerator, it's not just your TVs and stuff anymore. It's your refrigerator taking pictures to show you what you need and stuff. The more stuff they hook up, they have drinking fountains hooked up to the internet now. It's really everything, and it's all over the board on the manufacturer. So, and then once a even if it comes with security, once a new security feature is formed, many of them will never produce an update because they're already three generations of model down, and they're not going to take the time and investment to go back and fix something they were selling a year ago.
So we're in kind of this gold rush era of Internet of Things, and you're going to get what you get,
and
whether or not, you know.
Yep, people tend to buy the lowest cost, and the lower the cost you buy, the less support in the end you're going to have.
Okay, well,
you get what you pay for.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about CES. I still have that second question for you, Amos, and we will deal with that after this quick break. And welcome back to this third half of the January 5th edition of In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Kent Osborne. Amos Aesop and Jeff Litterick join me today on the show, and we're talking all things tech. Just a quick reminder, stay tuned after the show. Science Friday continues on, and they're going to talk a little bit about smartwatches and smartphones for the holidays. Did you get one? The tips for using VPNs, passwords, and beefing up your digital security. That's today on Science Friday, right after this show. So, good reason to stay tuned, that's a good thing. So it sounds like we have some festivities later in the afternoon as well, saying goodbye to a dear friend, and I'll certainly be listening as the day goes on. But dealing with the rest of the show here, if you'd like to give us a call, our number 800-524-3604, 956-STPB is where you can send a text. That's 956-7372. We'd love to hear from you for today's show. My other question was around these smart speakers or these devices in the houses that are in your office or wherever that you just talk to and get answers. Is anybody really gonna? There's a juggernaut right now is with Amazon with mm-hmm. the Echo,
mm-hmm.
and they're endless now. Seems like series of products in that line. Now they have screens and other devices. Is Google going to be able to catch up with their Home, and is Apple with their Pod, and how do you see that playing out?
You know, I'd argue that Google is doing a good job of keeping up, actually. I think in the realm of at least marketing, I see more ads and information about Google Home than than really anything else. And Google, you know, especially over the Christmas period, did a good job of marketing their smaller device. I forget what that one's called, but the Google Home Mini. Yeah, original, okay. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think they're doing a good job. All of the devices that I've been looking at that, you know, works with generally have Alexa and Google together. I've really seen some interesting applications that have come from Google Home. I personally don't have one of those. I've not actually even used one. But, you know, it's one of those things that Google's got some pretty serious R&D, just like Amazon does, into making that happen, because it really is, you know, the future. It's not going away. It's not something that was a flash in the pan you know, will die out anytime soon. We're all going to be speaking to a lot of our devices soon.
Oh, so it isn't necessarily, it can be in harmony. Many of these devices can be. It looks like LG is going to be building in the Google smart speakers into their TVs and soundbars.
Yeah,
in the future. So, yeah. So we're going to look.
And Sonos did that with Alexa.
So it isn't like you need to pick one and stick with it. You can have many.
You know, there's. It depends on your level of obsession with a particular brand or technology, right? Sometimes you want to stick with one to make sure that it all works, to make sure that you don't have to say to your speakers, you know, whatever the action word is for Google versus whatever the action word is for the Amazon devices.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to have to try to, I was supposed to tell Google that instead of Alexa. So, you know, you probably want to stick with that and stick with devices that then, you know, you've settled on, I'm one or the other. Otherwise, it's going to get confusing for everybody.
I'm laughing because, have you seen the video that Saturday Night Live did with the Alexa Silver Edition for seniors?
Oh, you know, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, you're going to, I'll post it to Facebook after this. But it's a very tongue-in-cheek look at... people calling their device different things, and it recognizes that. It knows that you're just missing the name.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's hilarious, and I will post a link to that. We have a caller on the line. Linda from Rapid City joins us. She has a question about flat screen TVs. Hi, Linda.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Thanks for helping me with this. I own three TVs. I have cable at home. It's not a premium package. I don't have HBO and stuff, but I do have probably 60 or 80 channels. So of my three TVs, one is a flat screen, and two of them are older ones that are a foot thick. You know, one of them even has a built-in VCR in it still. Works just mm-hmm. fine. In the last month or so-ish, when I turn on, for instance, the Weather Channel, and last week when it was freezy cold, I wanted to know how cold it was saying, the flat screen cuts off the bottom of the picture, so I can't see all those temperature statistics on the bottom. So I go turn on the old TV, that it's a pretty big one, that has the built-in VCR on the bottom, and mm-hmm. that shows the full screen, although it's slightly smaller. This is a new development, my flat screen that I've had probably 5 or 6 years, but it's advanced enough that it has the little deal in the back where I can plug in my thing for Netflix. And so there are probably a half a dozen or 10 channels that are HD, that I can watch ABC, for instance, on HD or non-HD on my flat screen, but mm-hmm. I don't have that option with, for instance, the Weather Channel.
Right.
So I don't know if there's anything I can do about it. Clearly, my cable provider or the Weather Channel have changed something, because everything else has been static for me.
That could be, or you may have like pressed a button on your remote that you didn't realize you pressed. Or the dog sat on it, or something. There's a.
I was going to say there's possibility for that.
there should be a button on your remote. Let me just grab one here and see if I can find out what the nomenclature is on this.
A lot of times, it has something to do with either aspect ratio or zoom picture mode.
This one's called ratio. This is on an LG remote. It could be that basically you're able to sort of resize that the picture on your TV, and you're supposed to make it fit better, basically. And you can, what I'd recommend is find that button on your remote and turn on the weather channel and cycle through the different modes. There's probably like a wide and a narrow and a letterbox sort of a mode or a widescreen, like a, you know, like a movie mode. And I would cycle through till you are able to see all the things on the screen that you want to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I should go look for, I know there's a menu button. I don't have my remote in front of me because I'm not at home right now. What does it say on the button on your remote?
Mine in front of me says ratio.
Okay.
But it may say other things, like zoom
or picture mode
or something.
And really, it's designed for pictures or video that's coming in that is not formatted for your TV size, so that you can resize it. Some people really don't like the letterboxing where you got the black bars above and below.
I've had that happen.
Yeah, and so, but really what you should be seeing is if that's a setting on your TV, you should be experiencing the same thing from channel to channel, because that wouldn't be a channel-specific setting. If you don't have text on the other ones, you might not notice it.
Well, like when they scroll on the morning TV shows, the news shows, they sometimes scroll other news or sports scores or something across the bottom, and you're right, it's cut off on other channels too.
Oh yeah, then it's definitely a picture setting. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
That should take care of
it. Because I didn't know if it was my TV or the cable provider, but based on what you're saying, I'll mess with my TV this weekend. I appreciate
it. Because those older TVs don't have that ability to resize the screen, it's going to work on those every time. So yep.
Yeah. Okay. And you may have to go back and forth depending on the channel, just to make it look the way you want it to. But hey, you know, that's what the remote's for. And enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for the call, Linda.
One quick thing is the why it's doing that is it's a feature on TVs called overscan. If you Google overscan for your TV, it probably will tell you the exact settings. And some of those are hidden settings that you can't normally get to. Without a special key press on the remote when it's powering up, but normally you can go in and fix that stuff.
Okay, great. Thanks for that update. Getting back to a couple of little CES things to wrap the show up, looks like there's some AV and VR technology. So the virtual reality and augmented reality things coming out from these VR companies have been kind of bought up. So it's Google. Now there's a thing called Magic Leap, and Facebook has Oculus now. Really looking forward to seeing some less bulky headgear.
It is bulky, isn't it?
And some additional features there. I've seen a few videos lately. Even DJI, the drone company, has put out some goggles for flying.
Oh, sure.
For racing drones, but also, you know, I think they work great with just aerial photography or whatever as well. Mm-hmm. So interested in checking that out in the new year and seeing, I guess, what CES brings us. And we'll probably just wrap that up on the next show. It's about the time CES is going to wrap up for the month. So we'll have a little bit clearer view of some VR tech on our next show. And we'll take that then. Just to wrap things up, any New Year's resolutions, Amos?
Tech-wise.
Or otherwise?
Nothing tech-wise. It's just all the standards of eating better and, you know, being more active, that sort of stuff.
Okay.
Maybe I can find some tech to actually help me with that, right? I suppose I do, because I use my phone and I use the built-in pedometer that's attached to my watch that, you know, makes sure you're taking the right number of steps and so forth. So there's tech involved.
I really wanted John T. Meyer here today because Zuckerberg... of course, from Facebook, he has a personal challenge every. We call them New Year's resolution. He calls them personal challenges. And so, in the past, he's been very much learn a language, start running, doing those sort of things. But his his personal challenge for the year is focusing on business. So he realizes that that his company does a lot of really important things now with, you know, elections and
sure.
And fake news and other things. And so his personal challenge for, or, you know, we call it New Year's resolution, is to focus on business, which I thought was
a good one.
Interesting.
Sure.
It certainly is good. Jeff, any personal challenges for you this year? Or are you going to try something new or focus on something old?
I haven't even thought about it. I have been so busy just getting through the whole Christmas through New Year stuff that I haven't even really thought about this upcoming year. Hopefully next week with sessions starting up and stuff, we can start laying some plans for the next year and stuff. I do want to build a new PC, hopefully with a better CPUs and better software, but we'll see how that goes. So.
Well, maybe that's we could do that as part of the show. We can watch you do that through video or whatever, and talk about that. That sounds like kind of a fun thing. Or maybe we can get some Raspberry Pi folks on, or maybe talk about design projects. I'm not real sure. Like you said, we just haven't had a whole lot of breathing room this year to really think about things with these chips. Chip issues being the prime focus of a lot of people's time since getting off of holiday. We'll have to come back, I guess, in 2 weeks and really think about some resolutions or, as Mark Zuckerberg says, personal challenges mm-hmm. for the year. But let folks know we're back on the air in 2 weeks. Coming up next, though, in this next hour, Science Friday is going to talk about smartwatches, smartphones. Did you get those for the holiday? They're going to talk about some problems and some cures. Also, they're going to talk about VPNs, something we've talked about on this program quite a bit. In fact, in the last couple of shows, we've talked about if you're going to be out using public Wi-Fi anywhere, the safety of VPNs. And if you still need that explained, Science Friday is going to take care of that in this next round, along with some passwords and beefing up your digital security as well, coming up in the next hour. So, Amos, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate that and all the work you do at Exigent and letting them let you come over here and spend your day with us or Absolutely. Part of your day. And Jeff Litterick with the Bureau of Information, Telecommunications, and Peer. Jeff, as we know, it's going to be a busy season for you coming up in the weeks with the legislators heading to Peer. And certainly SDPB will be there streaming everything live. We've been getting ready for that. And if you'd like more information on listening to your legislators at work or watching them in the afternoons, head on over to sd.net or sdpb.org/statehouse, and we will keep you connected with the people's business and peer as best we can, and certainly giving you access to everything that is going on up there. That's all the time we have for today's show. Again, thank you, Amos and Jeff, and I want to remind the listeners that SDPB is always there for you with our app at sdpb.org. Go there and click on listen. Have a great weekend, everybody.